Liberia go from a country ruled by the brutal dictator Charles Taylor to one whose president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has been praised for stabilizing her war-torn country? Well, one of the answers to that question is our guest, Lema Bowie. As a founder and leader of a coalition of Christian and Muslim women called the Liberian Mass Action for Peace, she organized public protests calling for an end to the civil war that had destroyed so much of her country. They confronted Taylor and the warlords, demanding a ceasefire and an end to rape and violence. They stormed the stalled negotiations, and at one point, Bowie threatened to strip if the soldiers forced them to leave. She even called for a sex strike to demonstrate the group's opposition to the long-standing conflict. Lema Bowie has written a memoir called Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. And she joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Lema Bowie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I do want to start where your book starts, but because I talked about the fact that you threatened to strip as you were protesting these stalled negotiations, what made you think of doing that? Or did you think?
Well, we had been at the peace talks for over 2.5 months, and we seemed to be going nowhere. And then constantly you went on the internet or listened to the radio, you heard of bombings and death. And this one particular morning, there was the death of two little boys and a girl. The boys were brushing their teeth outside, and the girl was hanging her baby clothes. She had given birth the night before when a shell missile landed in their compound. All that left of those children were really mashed like beef. And I saw it on the internet and imagine my own children. I just sat there crying, got up, went back to the peace hall and said to my mentor, Sugars, today we'll do something different. And then we decided to lock the delegates in. We locked them in. And when we locked them in, we sent a note in, like real hostage taking situation, saying, you are not coming out. We're not allowing food until this peace talk becomes a real peace talk. And for a moment, there was silence. And then after a while, people came. But the security officers came to arrest me. The rationale was that I was obstructing justice. And for me, that the use of that word justice, when you are suffering at the hands of some people and these people are the ones being protected, before my eyes, everything that I had been socialized to believe, the world protected women and children, men were the protector of women, it just flashed past me and a new realization hit me. In this world, you fight for yourself or you get nothing. So I told them, okay, if you're arresting me, fine, but I'm going to make it easy for you because when I get to prison, I have to put on prison dress. I'll just strip naked. But internally, for me, it was my personal protest, not just for the women, but for the children of Liberia that was being killed, for every angle of dignity that had left us. So it was like, you want to take the last shred of my dignity away, I'll give it to you.
And the idea of stripping, I mean, that would be shocking probably in any country, but in Liberia, how shocking would that have been?
In Africa, for a woman to strip naked in protest of someone's action, they say it's a bad omen. So at that moment, the securities who came to arrest me left me.
Meaning?
That they didn't want to be a part of anything that would cause any probably bad luck to follow their lives or whatever. But they left me when I started the process of stripping. And it was the Liberian men who came running to stop me from stripping. But one of the things that I've often been asked, so what difference does it make for men who have raped their women to be so concerned?
The answer, about a woman essentially taking off her clothes.
The answer to that came from one of our warlords. He said, at that point, there was not a single man in that room who didn't ask himself, what have we done to bring the mothers of our country to this place where they're thinking about giving away the last shred of their dignity? That was the feeling in that room. But the other thing is, even if you're being raped, you don't strip willingly.
No.
So if someone strips willingly in protest of a particular attitude, it means the pain they're feeling is beyond.
Do you think that changed those negotiations at that moment or maybe even over time?
I think it changed it at that moment because people became very sober. I mean, the hallway, we changed. We became more radical in the messages we're putting on our placards. the delegates changed their attitude towards us, wherein initially they had been disrespectful. It was nothing but respect.
Wow.
Because they understood then that these women mean business. But then beyond that, there was a somber, real change of mood. People now started looking at the peace talks like a real talk, because I think they realized that we have people that are holding us accountable for whatever we're doing in these rooms.
One more question. I know you've been asked about this a lot, but how much clothing did you actually take off?
I took off. Usually, because of the war, we are used to wearing, you wear your skirt and then you wear like a short pants under. And then, so because we're often threatened, so the wrap went off and it was the short pants that was going off when everyone came back to put the wrap around me.
And in hindsight, would you have gone all the way if people hadn't?
Definitely, because at that moment, I was in a state of total rage. And it's also that moment that made me to realize that, wow, you know, no one actually kill a group of people in anger being themselves. It's a moment of rage. And you can decide in this moment of rage that I will either take a gun or a knife and kill, or I will put this energy into something to show how angry I am. And in peace building, we always say that conflict is fluid like a liquid. The outcome of conflict is your own decision to put it either in a good container or a bad container. And at that moment, I think I put the anger and the rage I was feeling in a good container, that instead of inflicting pain on others, I will use myself to shame those who are inflicting pains on us.
Let me go back to the beginning. And your book actually begins when you were born in Liberia. And it sounds like you were born in a very close community. It sounds like your parents did not have a good marriage. But you lived in a community where people knew each other and it sounded like took care of each other.
Definitely. And if you compare my parents' marriage by American status, you definitely say yes. But by African status, they're still holding on at 73 and 63, respectively.
As we speak.
My dad is totally dependent on my mom. But they are still there. And it's just the two of them staying home now. Everyone else is gone. So they have to coexist. Having said that, I grew up in a community of different ethnic groups, different religious groups, but a very close-knitted community. So you really didn't miss a mother's hug or a dad's absence or a brother or sister. We didn't have brothers. We had cousins. We're all five girls. And the cousins kind of like compensated for the brothers that we didn't have. So it was a sweet. Hunger was never a thing, because I could go into any home and there would be food there for me to eat. If we went to the Muslim neighbors to play and it was 5 p.m., we took our bath in their homes and they sent us home to sleep.
And it was a Christian Muslim neighborhood?
Yes, it was a Christian Muslim neighborhood. We celebrated till today. We celebrated Ramadan. We ate. And I remember as a child, I used to cry why I didn't have on new clothes on Ramadan. And my parents were explaining that this is not our celebration, but we still found a way of taking bath and putting on something nice to be a part of the celebration, eating the food and being with the Muslim people in our community.
You describe in your book, and I have to say the passages about either warfare or conflict or violence or rape are really quite chilling. But you say that at the age of 17, you went from a child to an adult in a few hours. What did you witness?
Well, that morning we woke up and we were all getting ready to go to school this fateful morning in July. And my mother and sister would usually, my older sister who's deceased now, would usually go ahead, because they work at the public hospital. They would go ahead and then I would stay back with my other sister and would go to with my dad. But that morning, my dad wasn't around. So we decided we'll still stay back and take a taxi. My sister had gone and spent the night with her fiancé. And it was just my older sister, myself, my two younger siblings, nieces in the house with some guests. My mother left, and in like an hour after they left, we heard sporadic shooting. There was this old man who was in the house and said, "The rebels have arrived. I know the sound of the gun." And in like a matter of seconds, there were bullets raining all over automatically. I'm the only child of my parents in the home. I have to take charge. But beyond that, in like 1 hour, we see tons of people coming. They're internally displaced. They can go home. And our house has become a refuge for them. So I have to now start organizing food, organizing places for people to sleep. And so from 8 in the morning, you're 17-year-old, dependent on your parents, 12 noon, you are catering to over 35 people, and you have to decide who eats what, which window to block, who goes outside, who stays inside, what, how to arrange, how to protect your parents' property. You're looking into their bedroom, something you've never done, thinking, do they have important documents here that I need to pack? Is there money? Is there, you know, you just all of a sudden, and then you have these three, four very young children looking up to you and saying to you, Auntie, what are we doing? Or Lema, what are we doing? And then you're saying to yourself, geez, you know, this is real something. So for a week, I operate like that, thinking, okay, my mom is coming back home soon, or my dad is going to come home, and I'm going to just go back to being a child. My mother came in a serious state of traumatization. My sister came back traumatized, and it was on my head. From that moment up until I started having my own children, I never went back to my teenage years.
Wow. And during, was that the first time that you had heard the sort of fighting and gunfire
that was
associated
the,
with that?
Yes, that was the first. That was the first time, you know, sustained launching, bombing. Before you hear one pop in the night and you say, okay, someone is shooting. Or, but that day, it was like, and then bullets falling on the roof of the house like rain. And everyone down, I mean, it was really, really heavy fighting.
And as you say, and we're almost up in a break here, but as you say, everybody down. So the moment you would hear the gunfire, what, you would hit the floor, make sure you weren't in front of a door or a window, something like
first,
that?
My first instinct was the children. Come in, come in, come in. And then the next thing, off, away from the window. So everyone is down, and you have to stay down until the noise of the bullet goes away.
And how do you know it's over?
Yes, that's when you know it's over, because then it's quiet for a while and people can do bathroom breaks and other things. And then, but then that first day, we didn't know how to gauge it. By the second and third day, we realized that at a particular hour, it's heavy. And a particular hour, so you knew when the fighters would take a break. And that's when we can get up from our positions to look for food. And that's when we can go back, so yes.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Lema Bowie, a founder and leader of a coalition of Christian and Muslim women called the Liberian Mass Action for Peace. And they staged public protests in her country of Liberia, putting pressure on the president, then president, Charles Taylor, and the warlord. She's written a book about her life called Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Opera Company of Philadelphia launches a new season with Carmen, running in 5 performances September 30th through October 14th at the Academy of Music. This classic production features Renat Shahan in the title role, with an opening night simulcast live on Independence Mall. Information on Carmen at operaphila.org or 215-893-1018. The Opera Company of Philadelphia is proud to support WHYY.
The kids are back in school, and that means peace, quiet, and garlic planting time. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to grow the best-looking garlic on the block. Plus, sustainable farming hero Joel Salatin and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Prostate cancer is second only to skin cancer among U.S. men. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase's Prostate Cancer Risk Assessment Service helps you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of your family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, hearts plus minds.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and our guest today in this hour of Radio Times is Lema Bowie. She's a social worker, a peace activist from Liberia, and she is the executive director of Women, Peace, and Security Network Africa, and she's also the author of a memoir just published, Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War, the work that she and other women did in Liberia to bring about an end to the conflict and the fighting and the violence, and obviously joining us today on Radio Times. Any questions or comments you might have, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You also describe leaving for a refugee camp. It was in Ghana. And you were one of the first families or first people to arrive. But in a matter of, I'm not sure, days or weeks, something like 50,000 people were at this refugee camp. And you describe seeing no future for yourself at that point.
Yeah. We got to the camp, I think it was September 3rd, 1990. And we stayed at the port of Ghana for a few hours and was taken to the camp. In my mind, this camp was going to be a place that was well-structured. We have a bed. And we get there. This is an abandoned church, an old place where the buildings were all destroyed, and they took us to one of the last buildings and gave us a unfinished building with grass growing. We sat down, looked at my mother, and everyone started crying. So,
including you?
Yeah. There was this guy who knew us from our old road community, came and said, well, I have a nicer place. And the house that I was given, because there was like 20 Liberians who had flown in and we're giving that space. Say, I still have two rooms in this house, so you can come. So it was further in front. We got there. It was much nicer. The house had a roof and everything. So we moved in. And you look at this big empty space with no shed, no bathroom, no running water, nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And you ask yourself, have we landed in hell? Because the only difference from that place to Liberia was that there were no shooting. But that place was like Liberia in ways that you didn't have anywhere to go. You woke up in the morning, you were idle, you didn't think your life was moving anywhere. So it was the same except for the absence of violence. And you're just sitting there and saying, will we ever get... You're trapped. Trapped in a space, frozen in a particular time. And you're wondering, will I ever break free of this?
Well, interestingly, then you decide to go back to Monrovia, actually back to your father.
Yes.
Because you couldn't imagine a life for yourself, any future for yourself in that camp.
Never imagine a life. And then also one of the things that I've come to learn over time, having worked, I'm being a survivor of war and working with other victims of and survivors of war, is that the moment within which you leave your country, Is that moment of your traumatization. So you're frozen in that space, in that time. I was frozen in that time and was hoping that when I go back, everything will be different. In my young 17, 18-year-old mind, I was thinking that, okay, I've grown up to believe and really tested and tested the love of God, and everything I asked for as a young child, I got in my simple prayers. So he was going to answer the prayer, and one day we will wake up and this bad dream will be over. So when we got to Ghana and the dream didn't end, it still remained bad. There was another yearning. I want to go back. Maybe the dream will be different when I go back. Then I went back to Liberia.
And what did you find?
I went back to Liberia, and it was really, really shocking because there was even more destruction. There was even more death, and there was even more... Total lack of that sense of a future, nothing to look forward to, nothing to look up to, no one to even look up to. Even my dad was no help for me.
You eventually became, I guess, a social worker and were trained to deal with trauma victims doing healing. And some of the people that you worked with were these child soldiers that had been recruited to fight this war, many of them drugged, even brainwashed, young boys Who had done horrific things and had seen horrific things.
Yeah, When I started, I did a 3-month out of my idleness. I have a friend who's also deceased now, who came to me and said that the UN was starting a program for people who wanted to help. And not only were you going to get trained, you were going to be paid. And I was in a relationship where I thought I needed to get out. I needed to do something because the violence that I was feeling, my kids, everything. I just saw my life spiraling totally out of control. So I went and enrolled at this program. When I came back from my second phase of refugee life with kids, I decided to go back to school. And one of the requirements of that university was that we trained you first. You have to be practicing. So I went back to my church to ask them if they could give me a volunteer job. With my 3-month certificate, they said yes, and that they had a new set of clients, young child soldiers. And it was like, you have to deal with them. You have to design programs. You have to do everything. So that's how I started engaging. Ironically, these were the people that I was very angry at. I believe that they were the ones responsible for everything that happened in Liberia until I started working with them, got to know them. And today I still have a relationship with them. Yeah.
Seeing them as victims like yourself?
Totally. Because like a lot of the young children, when we really got to that place, first, as many social workers would know, when you're dealing with underprivileged or deprived people, the first story they tell you is never the truth. So the first time we meet, we talk, they didn't say the truth. By the time we got to know each other, and they really realized that I meant well, because the first time was like, who white man or white woman sent you to tell our stories and to get money? But when they realized that one, I was one broke woman working with them and helping them, then we really got to that friendship. And some of the stories were like a little boy called Sam, who was 8 or 9 years old when the shooting started in his community, like it started in my community. His mother had several children and he was like one of the older ones. She ran and he stayed back. And over time, he would go to where the fighters were and they would send him, go and bring water, go and bring this. I think he was like 9, 10. Eventually, they started teaching him how to shoot, recruited him, gave him drugs. And so by the time I met him, he was like 14, 15, and he was amputated. One arm had been amputated. So we started, and then I realized that he didn't have a choice. He really did not have a choice. If you left a 10-year-old back without any adult supervision, and that 10-year-old was suffering for survival, the first thing that presented itself and resembled an inkling of survival, he would cling to it. And so, unfortunately for him and for many of the other young children, that thing was the violence that they encounter. Some of the other children who I encountered had older brothers who had gone to war, and when they came back, they were celebrated in their villages. So they too said, I too can be a man. I'm going. And they came back. So those were the situation. And then I realized that these boys were exploited. They were abused. They were used. They were misused by a group of people. So then I had a new mission. Target those who arm these boys, not the boys, because they too are victims.
And that's Lema Bowie, our guest today on Radio Time. She's talking about her life and her work in Liberia. She's also the author of a new memoir called Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. And we'll be talking about her work with other women to protest the violence and the fighting and the rape in her country. But I do want to talk a little bit about your marriage. You mentioned that. You also write about this in your book. You're the mother of 6 children.
Yeah.
And this was an abusive relationship.
Yes, the first few years, I, out of my anger, being a victim of what anger at everyone but myself, I said life was just about eat, drink, and enjoy. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I bet someone that we had a relationship and had several children, and it first it was fun. Because I was being the rebel all along. I'd been the good child, the one going to look for food during the war for my family. Whatever my parents said I did, I suffered from something I like to call the pleaser's disease.
Oh, please
and,
us.
Yes. Right. And by the time I met this guy, it was like, okay, this is someone who was dubbed a very bad person, but I thought I can play. And in playing, the first child came, then the second, then the third. And then I realized that I was trapped in a violent, abusive relationship. No way out. My family had given up on me. They did not want to have anything to do with where I found myself. And it was just difficult, a really difficult thing for me. I had my kids, but these kids were watching me. My son was watching me being abused every day. I remember there was this one morning that I was violently slapped. And I saw this three-year-old come between me and his father and say, "Why did you hit her? Don't do that again." I'm way up here and he's down there and he's trying to protect me. I stayed in it for several years. And then at some point I told myself, you have to get out.
You know, it sounds like, and I don't want to make too much of this, but the sort of warfare in your own family was rather like the warfare that was happening in Liberia.
Definitely. And one of the things that I've learned, and I tell people that my experience in this life and in what I write in the book is something that cuts across. So I can comfortably speak to women who are going through war, speak to single mothers, speak to women who are currently going through domestic violence, because I think I've gone through quite a bit of everything on that spectrum, or all of the spectrum that women would go through. And I know that I can also speak to families who have girls who are following, quote unquote, the rebel or not the ideal man. Until you create that space of protection for your daughter, she will continue to sink. Because I think when I had my first child, if my parents had offered to bring me home and to just be loving regardless of my fault, I may not have stayed for that long. But when they were like, okay, congratulations on this first baby, go home with your husband, he reinforced it. I told you, those people hate you. So I am torn between someone who professed to love me, punch me up every now and then buy me a present, and people who were just giving me cold shoulders. Then the second child, then the third child, and then in the process of having my third child, the war came, we went home to my parents, and it was total isolation. I was like, okay, then this is where I belong. This is I would just rather stay with this person.
But, you know, it's so interesting. I think for some people, they might have stayed in that situation or even stayed depressed, as you write in your book. But you went on to become a founder, a leader of this group, the Liberian Mass Action for Peace, organizing women in Liberia to challenge the government, to take on the soldiers, the establishment. Where do you think that came from?
It didn't come overnight. I can definitely say it to you. One of my most memorable moments was after I left the relationship and came back home, and my mother and I, we have a bittersweet relationship, and she has my third child on her back, and we're sweeping and making a bonfire and just talking, chatting. All of a sudden she said to me, "What do you want to do with your life?"
Wow.
And she said,
had she ever asked you that before?
Nope. My dad was the one who was constantly raining insults on me, but she never. And then she said to me, "I'll make a promise to you tonight under these stars." And by that time, I was a total mess. Tears was just running because I was also pregnant with my fourth child, and she and I were keeping a secret from my dad. She said, "I will hold your hands. I will support you. I will walk with you if you decide to make something out of your life."
Wow.
I had the fourth child. It was a big issue. My dad was like, "Leave my house." And my mom was the one who was kind of like calming him down, talking to him. And then I said, I'll look for a job. And I know she was the one who went to that church group to ask them if they could hire me because she knew the pastor. When they took me to work with them, and then I enrolled back in the social work college, my mom stood by her word. She helped me take care of those children. After year two, in college, I decided to move out, and she was really angry because she had gotten used to the kids. So she didn't think I was competent enough to take care of the children. But we've been on our own for several years now, and I've proven her wrong.
But the idea of staging protests and organizing women and taking to the streets, you all wore white. I mean, this was a very organized protest against this ongoing conflict in your country. Were you scared to do something like that? Or did you feel like this is something I must do?
I felt like, you know, you have no option. Honestly, I didn't sit down and think, because the women kind of like it was just like pushing you into it. They called me for a meeting. I had resigned my job like 2 days before. The next day I'm home, I'm sick, and just chilling, as they will say. And someone calls and say, we need to meet with you tomorrow. It's getting rough again. We go to this meeting. I'm like, okay, I'm here to give you the technical support. I know peace building. You have the enthusiasm and the passion. We can put it all together.
You take care of it.
Yes.
Right?
So as we're there, and then they look at me and said, no, you're going to lead this thing. And I'm like, no way. Say, Lima, you started the Christian Women Peace Initiative from a dream. You continue to drive that group. You help us organize the Muslim women. There's no way that we can take you out of this. You've started the Women Peace Building Network. In this country, we're growing. We think you are the leader. I said, okay, let's call a bigger meeting. Bigger meeting. The women was like, yes. A bigger meeting, yes. A bigger meeting, yes. And then finally, some of the women were like, no, you know, your life, you know, as always, the private life of a woman is the first thing that is threatened or exposed when you have to do a piece of public job. And then some of the older Christian women came to those women and said, open your Bible. The Muslim women were like, open your Quran. God uses the foolish things of this world to confront the wise. This is her. David was not perfect. And they went on, you remember Rahab, the prostitute, they use her, and different. So if you don't feel comfortable, this is the leader that we have, you can step out of this group. And honestly, some people left, but some stayed. And so it wasn't like laying down and thinking. So as we started the protest and all of the challenges from different sides were coming some nights, I sat up in my bed and I cried and said to God, why do you hate me so much by punishing me with this group of women?
And did they feel that way about you?
Sometimes I got heated. I don't think they ever felt that way. Right. Sometimes they said I was a little bit arrogant. Sometimes I was cocky. Sometimes they had different ways of calling me. But at the end of the day, all they would look at me and say, but you're a very good leader. And I felt good. But sometimes I felt like I resigned more than 1,000 times.
Out of frustration,
because we will go to meetings and they will say, we'll do this. And if we did an activity that was a flop, it all fell back on me. You told us to do it.
Let's take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Lema Bobi today on Radio Times, founder and leader of a coalition of Christian and Muslim women, as she was just saying, called the Liberian Mass Action for Peace, and they stage protests in her native country of Liberia. She writes about this in her new book, a memoir called Mighty Be Our Powers, and she is also the executive director of the Women, Peace, and Security Network Africa, obviously joining us today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Penswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A new report says 12% of the country's bridges need to be rebuilt. One in southern Indiana was just shut down after cracks were found. We'll take a look at the country's aging and ailing infrastructure. Also, a leading Chinese writer flees the country, but does that mean the government wins? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Division of Continuing Studies at the University of the Arts supports WHYY. With more than 70 classes and workshops for adults, Continuing Studies also offers 8 certificate programs for working creative professionals and teaching artists. Certificate programs include web development, print and web design, photography, and more. An open house and career fair will be held on September 21st. Details at cs.uarts.edu. Continuing Studies at the University of the Arts, cs.uarts.edu.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen here on WHYY in Philadelphia, talking with Lema Bobi, and she's a social worker, a peace activist from Liberia. We're talking about the work that she and other women did in her country to help bring about the end to 14 years of fighting there, and she has a new memoir called Mighty Be Our Powers. Again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. It's so amazing, though, to think of you and these other women taking to the streets, protesting. There are photographs in here of you. This is a violent country. It's a country of chaos. Rape is common. And yet, for some reason, and perhaps you know why, you were not attacked. You were seen as a different kind of force in Liberia at this time. Why do you think that was?
Well, first, when we started, people really did not take us seriously. These were a bunch of toothless bulldogs and different names. Some said we were prostitutes looking for husbands, different things. But by the time we persevere 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, people started to really paying attention and sitting in the rain. It was like, okay, if these women are just sitting there, you know, but also what we had in our favor was war fatigue. 14 years, young men losing their limbs and realizing that they were not gaining anything from killing up their people or doing different things. So it was like, this is a breath of fresh air. A country that had destroyed itself, a group of people that had destroyed themselves, that we had sunk to the bottom of the pit. And there was no way that we were going to come up if we would have just keep going further, or there was no space to go even further, because I think Liberia was at the depth of her self-destruction. Mm-hmm. So when we step out, people saw something different. They saw something new. 14 years, it's only violence. Every other person who had stepped out to say they wanted to change the situation came with a barrel of the gun. We came armed with just our broken bodies, white t-shirts, headscarves. So it was different. Then we got to the place where in communities, even the fighters, were the ones saying to us, you know what? Go here. Go there. Don't wait. Don't go there yet.
They were protecting us,
yes.
You were also determined to talk to Charles Taylor. You wanted to speak to him directly. You did. What did you tell him?
Well, we had prepared a text, and working with a group of women is never an easy thing.
Why does that not surprise me?
This text we had to read, not just in English, but every other local vernacular that was part of the movement to say, okay, we approve. Because we don't want you to put anything political in that statement. What they did not understand was that the personal is political. So we don't want you to say Taylor should step down. We don't want you. We just want peace, peace, peace. So they prepared this statement, gave it to me, and said, read. So I went and read the statement. But I still felt like something is missing. This is too decent for an indecent person. This is too proper for an improper person. This is too good for an evil person. I need to give him something that will make him to think. So after I read the statement, instead of presenting it, I went back to them to say, you know what, Mr. President, the women of Liberia, we are tired running. We are tired watching our children being raped, because this was our daily situation, things that we were faced with, things that we're seeing, our everyday experience. And there is no way I can stand before the perpetrator of violence and not tell him how I felt. And at that moment, it wasn't about me. It was about those almost 2,000 women who were sitting and praying for me as I spoke to him.
So what did he say?
We're tired. We're tired running. We're tired with relief food. We're tired observing our children being raped. We're tired seeing our sons being armed. And we're taking this stand to secure our society, because tomorrow, when our children ask us, what was your role? We want to be able to say to them, we fought for peace.
So what did Charles Taylor say or do?
He stood up and cleared his throat and said he had been suffering from serious flu. That's why he did not meet with us earlier, but it's only his mother's that could get him out of his sick bed, and then we extracted a promise from him that he was going to now submit to the peace talks. But he gave us a challenge. In order for me to know that this process is not just targeting me, I want you all to deliver similar statements to the rebels. So afterwards, yes, we had to send people to Sierra Leone, where the rebels had a meeting with different groups, and they presented the statement to them.
And that takes us to where we began our interview, when they were meeting and negotiating, and things were bogging down. Yeah. You also, I guess, took a page from Lysistrata, and at one point, I guess, out of frustration, said, as women, we're going to deny sex to our men as a way of protesting this war. What was the reaction to that?
Well, first, I didn't know the Greek play.
Oh, you didn't?
Never read it. It was only after Pray the Devil Back to Hell that someone gave me a copy.
That's a documentary.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was Asatu, the Muslim woman, who was like, you know what? These men have been doing this war, and we are in the vanguard for peace. But we don't get the sense that they're actually doing anything to kind of like complement our efforts. So we need to take it into our homes. Let our husbands now start talking to their buddies to put down the guns, to do this. They have the power, because they are the ones sitting around the table, and we deny. By the time we said sex strike, the media,
oh, I bet,
frenzy. Even for an African country.
Good media, bad media?
Bad media, specifically, because the question was, some of the journalists were asking us, what did we do? We are not the fighters. Why are you depriving us? Why should we suffer twice? We're afraid for our lives, and we'll come to our wives for comfort. You're saying no to us. But the answer was certain. We were not strategic in the urban areas, because we just went for sex strike. In the rural areas where the women were protesting, mm-hmm. These women took our message of a sex strike and took it to another level. They called their husbands and said, we're fasting and praying for peace. And biblically, fasting has to do with denying yourself of the pleasures of this world. So until peace can come, we cannot have sex. They were more effective. There weren't any complaints from those areas about domestic violence. Meanwhile, in the urban areas, the women were coming and saying, I was forced last night. We fought because of this. And then we were like, okay, wherever you stop, move on from there.
So do you think nonviolence, I know you're dedicating your life to nonviolence. Does it work?
It does.
By itself?
It does. But it is the most difficult. And I mean, just sitting on this public radio, I will take off my hat to King and to Gandhi again.
Martin Luther King?
Yes. Because it's easy. The easiest thing for anyone to do is to pick a gun and shoot. The most difficult thing for anyone to do is to look at the killers of your children and engage them. Speaking truth to them. Not making yourself humble or in any way, but just standing up with your shoulders upright, looking them straight in the eye and say to them, what you're doing is wrong. That is the most difficult thing, because the number of emotions or the feeling that goes through your body is something that no one can explain. But if any group of people or any individual is able to dedicate an entire life to not using violence, at the end of the day, even those that use violence will start to have a change of mind. If I'm killing these people and they continue to do this, why don't I change? Mm. So it's tedious, it's long, but it's possible.
Have you been threatened in your work?
Not directly. We've heard stories, and no one has come to say this is going to directly to say, but we've heard stories that, oh, there is a plan to have you beaten or to have you, and I never really take it seriously. I keep going because it's a mission. You have your work to do. And if you keep listening to all of these fear tactics, you may never really get to the place you want to get to.
Let me get Don from Philadelphia to join us. And this is Don Dennis, Vice President of the Liberian Coalition of Pennsylvania. And Don, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, Ms. Bailey, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Yeah, I just want to commend her for that stand that it took years ago to get our country to where it is now. My question is that prior to making that decision to go on strike, at what point did you really came about with that decision. It's just say it's about time that we, the women, come up and fight against these men who are power greeders and not seeking peace in this country.
Yeah, was there, I guess, a moment where you just felt like you'd had enough?
We, in July of 2002, we gathered a group of community women together where we were having conversations about peace and the role of women. After a week of just sitting and talking, these women came back and said, you know what, we need to go back and mobilize more women. And as we mobilized more women, early 2003, it was the moment of reckoning, I would say, because then all of the stories of two different rebel groups attacking from different angles, you're listening to the news, you're seeing family members come down from upcountry, and we came back together and said, it's time. Oh. It's time. But beyond that, we were living in a state of that February of that year. I had gone to southeastern Liberia, and we were crossing between a place called Nimba and Grand Jide. We're going to mediate a conflict in the Lutheran church at the time. We got to that village that morning, just the border town of Nimba and Grand Jide. And a truck just came and caught in front of the pickup we were driving in. People were fleeing left and right, and we were sitting in the pickup frozen. What was happening in that village was forced recruitment at that moment. Every able-bodied man, woman, girl, or boy was thrown into that truck and they drove away. It's like for some reason the eyes of those soldiers were covered to us sitting in the pickup, because I could have been one of those recruited.
Sure.
Those in the pickup could have been one of those recruited. We came back to Monrovia, but coming back, we had that event going. 1 week later, coming back, there was another incident. And by the time we went back to Monrovia, having conversations with my sisters, they were saying, this is bad. And I said, this is what I saw. We need to do something. We need to come together. Void of our differences, ethnic, social, political, it's time that we speak with one voice. But we had been preparing ourselves a year earlier by doing solidarity messages. Does the bullet know a Christian from a Muslim? Can the bullet choose a different ethnic group from another? So that was our rallying point. When a group of men come to rape, do they separate the Muslim from the Christians? You know, all of those different things. And at the end of the day, those messages really just resonated with those women. And early 2003 was when we started.
Do you think there's a connection between the work that you and other women have been doing in Liberia and the election of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf? She's the first woman president of an African country.
Like I said in the documentary, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, there's no way that the history of Madam Sirleaf can be written without the history of our work. By the time the peace agreement was signed in August of 2003, we went back to Liberia determined not to go back to the kitchen, not to go back into our homes and start taking care of babies. We will be involved. We had something we call constructive interference. So we were out disarming boys. When it came time for civic and voters education, we were out educating women. When it came time for voters registration, we did a kind of registration that got us 50 plus one more women registered than men. And when it was time for campaigning, those women who had not been politically conscious before were out there saying, it is our time. It's time. Giving all of the work that we've done for peace. And some of the men who encounter us said to us, you know what? I think it's time to roll Liberia back, the leadership of Liberia, to women. Let's give them a try. Let's see what they can do with this country, because they did a great job for peace. So I think even if we don't take 100% credit, we take some credit for just mobilizing, energizing women to step into the space and vote.
You describe at the end of your book, in fact, a chapter is The War Really Over, talking about the aftermath of this 14-year war. Obviously, the effect on just buildings and roads, but also the psychological damage that this war has really inflicted on Liberia. Can you talk about that?
Wow. I mentioned that I still have a relationship with a group of with the young fighters that I worked with. And one of the features of their lives is standing by the doors of supermarkets in Monrovia and begging for cash or begging for food. But these are children who have gone on to have their own children, and they live in abject poverty. We still do not have we have some programs, but we do not have sustained programs to kind of like reintegrate these young people back into society and really do a full rehabilitation. That's the first group of people that I want to talk about. Then you have those women who live through the pains of war. We went to one of the villages a few years ago to do one of our sitting sessions with the women just to talk after the war, after peace had been signed. And this woman called me and said, I have a predicament that I need to talk to you about. She said, my son died during the war. He was killed by a fighter. My daughter fled. She wrote me a few months ago that she's coming back home from Ghana as a refugee. She married over the years. She has children. And she has a husband who's supposedly a pastor. They sent me pictures. Her husband is the killer of my son.
Oh, my gosh.
What do I do?
What do you do?
I ran away from her. I'm being very honest. I turned to one of the other sisters and said, talk to her. I'll come back. But I avoided her for the entire time we found ourselves in the village. But these are the stories of the women. These are the stories of women who were raped. And are still struggling to tell their children, I'm HIV positive because I was raped. Some of these women tell stories of men using knife blades in their private parts. You still have that whole generation or whole population of people who cannot really clearly come out to say this. How do you deal with that? And then you have the whole issue of poverty.
I thank you for joining us, and I thank you for your work as well. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And our guest has been Lema Bobi, and her book is called Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. She's speaking this evening at Villanova University, whose Center for Peace and Justice Education is giving her the Adela Dwyer St. Thomas of Villanova Peace Award. Bob Ball's the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.